You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband, let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main expanding countries are the United States, China and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
No, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McComb. During the last week, I had the pleasure of catching up with friends I hadn't seen for a while, and it wasn't long before I was engaged in a discussion about plasma and LCD TVs. After 10 minutes of banter, I had a refreshing reminder of just what it's like to be a non-technical consumer wanting to buy into the world of home entertainment. It seems that 20-something store assistants are keen to make a sale and will tell a consumer almost anything to get them to sign on the dotted line. Apologies to the few passionate and well-informed sales reps. Add to this the inflationary buy now and pay in 4 years' time with no interest ever offers, and it makes converting the sale all that more easier. Professionally speaking, I find it hard keeping up with the transition of television from analog to digital because of the continuing government policy changes and the changing business decisions by the television networks. So what hope do the white goods sales guys and consumers have? Add to this mix the high definition transition, and it's no wonder most consumers throw their hands in the air and curl up in the fetal position on the floor.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
If you're looking to buy or upgrade a server in your business, I talked to Martin Gregory, Director of Server Tools and Platform Strategy from Microsoft Australia about Windows Server 2008. It's been 5 years since Server 2003 hit the streets, and there's been plenty of changes for the better. It's even more human-friendly. And our girl on the streets in the home of technology, Lydia Davis, joins us from Silicon Valley to tell us all about StumbleUpon. Also on the show, it's sex and more sex in the Asian domain name scramble, the ACCC to expose fake excuses for broadband delays, more iPod copies hit the marketplace, Adam Turner talks about online backups, and three Apple stores set to hit Australia's shores later this year. First up, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk for this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, the ACCC powerless as Telstra runs out of space, Census gears up for the iPhone launch, a Gmail Trojan makes money from stolen passwords, the ABC jumps into digital hyperdrive, and heritage computers facing the scrap heap. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Australian Competition and Consumer Commission Chairman Graham Samuel told the Australian Telecommunications User Group last week that he was focused on ensuring there are minimal impediments to firms being able to make investments. But Mr. Samuel conceded there was little the ACCC could do if Telstra was running out of space in their telephone exchanges. Speaking at the 24th annual conference at Australian Technology Park in Sydney, Mr. Samuel said, "Competition continues to drive investment either through the upgrade of existing wireless networks or in the continuing installation of digital subscriber line access multiplexes in exchanges, where over the past year the number of unbundled local loops has roughly doubled." But Mr. Samuel sided with Telstra in the debate over the treatment of Telstra's competitors wanting to install DSLAM equipment in Telstra exchanges. DSLAMs provide high-speed broadband services over Telstra's copper wire. Mr. Samuel said there may be real physical impediments in Telstra's exchanges that mean competitors cannot be provided access. The comments come after one of Telstra's competitors, Primus Telecom, made claims that it had experienced long delays in installing DSLAMs in Telstra exchanges, in some cases up to 2 years. Telstra responded by saying its competitors seeking exchange space were treated on a first-come, first-served basis until exchanges were full. Although Apple has yet to announce a date for the Australian release of its iPhone, Telstra's Census is already creating mobile applications specifically for the local market. Census, which is the advertising and directories arm of Telstra, has advertised for a business analyst to create iPhone search applications. A job advertisement says that Census is looking for a business analyst with a technical front-end user interface background to help design cutting-edge search applications for the iPhone. The Age Tech last week reported that some have read this as evidence that Telstra may have won exclusive rights to sell the iPhone down under. Census corporate affairs advisor Danielle Horan said the company did not know which carrier would bring the iPhone to Australia at this stage. In the United States, Apple's hybrid mobile telephone and music player is believed to be responsible for a surge in mobile web browsing, attributed to its ability to display websites just as they appear on a regular PC. A utility released last year by Mate MediaSoft, designed to archive online mail and other content from Gmail accounts, has instead been shown to harvest usernames and passwords while charging users $29.95 for the privilege. G-Archiver version 1.0 was released in April 2007 and duplicates Gmail accounts on users' hard disks. Gmail is the popular free email and content management system run by Google. With G-Archiver, users are required to enter their Gmail usernames and passwords before G-Archiver connects and downloads online content from the users' Gmail accounts. A software developer, Dustin Brooks, was reportedly trying to reverse engineer G-Archiver when he made a disturbing discovery. G-Archiver not only logged on to his Gmail account, but emailed his username and password to another Gmail address. Brooks reportedly logged into Gmail with the hard-coded address and found nearly 1,800 emails generated by G-Archiver, all containing the usernames and passwords of other people using G-Archiver. A message on the garchiver.com website says this week, it has come to our attention that a flaw in the coding of garchiver may have revealed customers' Gmail account usernames and passwords. It is urgent that you remove the current version of garchiver from your computer and change your Gmail account password right away. A member of our development team had inserted coding used for testing garchiver in the debug version and forgot to delete it in the final release version. We sincerely apologise and assure you that this coding mishap was in no way intentional. Mate MediaSoft also distributes software for bulk adding friends into Web 2.0 networks such as MySpace and YouTube, which also require login credentials to perform their tasks. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation last week announced the construction of a new 24/7 continuous news centre in Ultimo, Sydney, and more than 60 new websites pushing local news to regional communities. A new internet television service will also enable viewers to watch full-screen video content on their computers, including programs recently aired on ABC One and ABC Two. The internet TV channel will go live on Tuesday this week and has been dubbed ABC Playback. The new service will include natural history programs and content available for purchase by digital download from the ABC shop. ABC's Managing Director Mark Scott told the Sydney Morning Herald last week that the content on the 60 new websites would be created from existing resources and that no additional journalists would produce extra content. Christopher Warren, Federal Secretary of the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, said he was concerned that staff may be lumbered with a significantly increased workload and said that staff were very conscious of the extra pressure that this work puts on people, particularly in regional areas. The Age Tech last week noted that of the five main television broadcasters, the ABC has to date been the most innovative in terms of taking advantage of new technologies. And finally, a computer history museum in Sydney's southwest is facing closure, and the electronic relics could be lost forever unless storage space can be found by the 1st of April. The Australian Computer Museum Society has artefacts which are loaned from collections worldwide, including one of Australia's first computers, the University of Sydney's Ciliac machine, and parts of a 1920s machine used to calculate odds at horse races. The collection's current home has been on a 5-year loan to the Society, but according to Society President John Dean, some of the collection could end up as scrap metal if a new home isn't found soon. The Society has been unsuccessful in finding a new home for the museum, despite inquiries with the National Trust of Australia, New South Wales government departments, the City of Sydney Council, universities, and Sydney's Powerhouse Museum. Mr. Dean said that what we're losing is a sense of perspective, and that while the collection was of no value, it was certainly irreplaceable. Tech Talk News was compiled by Dr. Ron, and I'm Graham Callaghan, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
As you mentioned, Dr. Ron, in the news, Telstra has lost the ACCC court case.
Bye-bye.
The network's probably ready for fibre to the node now. I don't think he's looking at social welfare just yet.
No, his net worth is $58 billion.
Good on him.
Yeah. How simple is it to get a Linux box up and running something like a word processor on it?
It's as easy as installing Windows on a machine, really, these days.
Tech Talk Radio reveals that 100% of people surveyed thinks that iTunes is crap.
It's just scary at the moment, especially when you've got kids.
It's not very convenient to be forced to upgrade every other week to get features that you can't even use in this country.
You don't have to upgrade, but of course if you don't upgrade, then there can be some security holes left behind.
Biometrics, in a different sort of way.
Cyberstorm.
It is. It's a big database that all the agencies have got access to, so you've got them all flummoxed over here. And that's the big problem with enforcement on the internet.
You boys are playing games.
Nothing.
Top day, are there?
No, face the front.
Okay,
it's all correct.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
It's amazing what you learn on our news, Dr. Ron and Graham. That was sensationally well put together, but I think we should have a competition as to how many times Graham said G-Archiver. What about a coffee mug, Dr. Ron? Do you think for that? Yeah, G-Archiver, the first correct answer gets a coffee mug.
It was a bit of a rough draft, that one, and I was actually planning to record the news, and I said to Graham, no, you can record it this week, and email it to him, and it hadn't really been through its final edit, had it?
Well, it was a bit of copy editing going on, but it was good. There's some good stories in there, which is always what we look for in the news.
Absolutely. So, you get through all the spelling mistakes and the formatting errors.
Yes. And, yeah, translated some of it into English for you, but yeah, that works out all right.
And I thought the closure of the Sydney Technological Museum, they could move that to your joint, Dr. Ron. I reckon you've got plenty of space there upstairs.
I've got my own museum, thanks very much.
Have
I need somebody else's as well.
Well, put that together with JD's Apple
Orchard
Museum. Oh, there's a wealth of that sort of stuff going on just in the local area here.
Too right. Hello, everybody. Sorry, we'll continue the show now. I'm Andrew McCormick. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Graham Callaghan and Dr. Ron at the panel tonight. We've got a bit of a good show tonight. We've got Microsoft in. In spirit, we've been having a chat to them about Server 2008. Lydia Davis, our girl on the street in Palo Alto in California, Silicon Valley, known to those outside of the country. She's going to be talking about StumbleUpon. Have you guys used StumbleUpon? Have you stumbled upon StumbleUpon?
Yeah, I've stumbled upon StumbleUpon. It's an interesting little idea. It's one of these website recommendation sort of sites, isn't it?
Yeah, I did a bit of a straw poll in the office, and everyone said StumbleUpon. I heard of it, don't know what it is. So Liz's going to tell us all about it tonight.
Cool.
I look forward to that. It's a little bit like Delicious, I think.
Yes. Yeah, a little bit along those lines, yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so she'll be telling us all about some of these social networking sites and how they work over the course of the next few weeks, with all things going according to plan. All right, let's chat. There's all sorts of things Telstra-ish happening this week. The ACCC can't find a fix for Telstra's complaint. Let's start off with... Actually, before we do that, as you mentioned in the news, Graham, DSLAM space in Telstra Exchange is becoming a bit of...
It's becoming a bit of a hot topic because, there's a certain number of exchanges. I think there's 80-something exchanges, is that right? Has anyone got the figures to hand?
Nah.
Where there's literally no room in the building. There's no room to expand.
I can believe that. I can tell you, Dr. Ron, you and I, our exchange suffers from just this.
Does it? Is this a problem?
Yeah, that's the reason why you go to ADSL2exchanges.com or whatever it was. We had our website of the week not so long back. And if you look at all exchanges, you'll see a few of them have just got nothing there.
Yeah, and that's probably the reason. There's the telephone exchange, the Telstra equipment, it occupies the entire space on the site. There's nowhere to put any new equipment. And, therefore, other suppliers can't get in there to install ADSL2 equipment like they have in most exchanges around the country.
Well, some of these exchanges have been there for 30, 40, 50 years.
Yes.
And the copper that we pay for our unbundled local loop on has not been maintained in that time either.
Oh, that's right. And the things were built and designed for when the housing estates were
built 50 years ago, right. And yep. There's just no...
When everybody had big backyards and you didn't have three blocks on, you know three little flats on what used to be one big block, and everybody's now got two or three phone lines, and they've got the internet and a phone line and a fax line, and yeah.
This is just it, so it's not...
The whole thing's expanded out too much.
Exactly, it's not Telstra just trying to be... obstructionist, I suppose, it is a very serious problem. They just literally run out of physical space to put stuff.
I can't see them being in a huge hurry to renovate for a,
well, you'd have
a
to
resellable
build,
product, would you?
You'd have to build upwards, or you'd have to build a completely new exchange.
But when you think with all the everything getting smaller, faster, better, that rack space will become available as we get large-scale integration of componentry and switches and
well,
things like that?
Well, to some degree, you'd think that. And certainly some of the switching equipment probably takes up a lot less space. But the demand for lines has probably quadrupled in the amount of time since the equipment's got smaller, but the demand's got bigger. And some parts of the equipment, like the physical, termination blocks and the patch panels, I don't know what they call them, the technical, who's in me, what are the things that they plug their wires into, still, for a pair of wires, still has to take up a certain amount of space.
You still have a distribution frame, and it still has to
be... That's the gizmo watch that I was talking about. Yeah.
That's the one.
I love those technical terms. They're good.
It still has to be a certain size, and the other thing you quite rightly see, Graham, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, everybody had one telephone line to their house, but now two or three telephone lines is not uncommon.
Yeah, and a block that had one house with one line has now got three flats, and each of those has got more than one line. Yeah.
That's it. And this is really what the ACCC can't fix. Australia's competition regulator has conceded there is little it can do to overcome physical space constraints that have caused problems for smaller telcos trying to install broadband equipment in the Telstra exchanges. So I guess the short-term solution is mobile broadband or move if you're looking for ADSL too. But having said that, a real-world experience that I can personally speak for is the ADSL 2 that I currently have is only marginally faster than the ADSL 1 flat NACA that I used to have.
Mm-hmm.
So for the sake of, maybe 2 or 3 meg, and if you are living on one of these physically size-impaired, size-challenged exchanges, just go the flat NACA ADSL 1 flat out until such time as you can go somewhere else.
Yeah, find someone with the uncapped ADSL 1 is probably the way to go, yeah.
Yeah.
The ADSL 2 really only affects people within a fairly close distance to the exchange. Interesting stuff.
All right, the government's going to commit $95 million to regional broadband. This is another plan that's come out of them up there in Canberra. The federal government says that it will spend $95 million ensuring Australians living in remote areas can receive internet services comparable to broadband in metropolitan areas. Mr Conroy says remote areas will instead have the best fixed line, wireless or satellite technology installed. Here we go again. This is all I can say. Like, we don't want to lose listeners, but it's the same old, basically, each week, isn't it?
Didn't we have a plan for this the other week?
Yeah. I thought so. Wasn't it called Opel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Optus Elders Consortium, yeah.
Yeah. The minister has also announced an expert panel to assess the proposals to build the national broadband network. And as I think JD alluded to in one of our recent shows, which I think I heard in the tease tonight, hasn't fibre to the node already been built?
Is this an election promise, or is it something that's been subsequently announced?
It may have been an election promise.
There were a lot
but
of...
I think broadband to the bush was out there originally, because that's what Senator Helen Coonan...
That's right. That was what all
pushed the boundaries
of debates were about.
Yeah. She's gone quiet all of a sudden, too. I know she's not in office anymore, but that didn't stop her in the past.
No, after she got knocked down from...
I haven't read the Financial Review of late, but she might pop up there. But yes, I think it's only fair that rural Australia, where possible, can have the advantages of what we have here, because it's only going to get faster. And you wouldn't want to miss out on that, because, yes, it's one of those essential services, I think, these days. Not that you can get a guarantee, like the customer service guarantee. That'd be good if you could do that. Because you can spend forever waiting for an internet connection to be put in the right way, then you go back at the queue if they stuff it up, like your address is wrong, or your pair doesn't match, or someone's typed the wrong number somewhere, you have to go back to the top of the queue and wait another 14 days. But we won't go there.
But it is a service that you need connected. In order to do business properly, you need a telephone line, you need water connected, you need electricity, and you need internet access in this day and age. That's the 21st century, so it should be accessible by everybody.
Another interesting news, which the Australian was talking about during the course of the week, the federal government has given the two public 2 weeks to have their say on plans to invest in the $4.7 billion national broadband network. Like, Mr. Conroy, it's a bit late, isn't it?
excuse my cynical hat here, and you know that I do wear it from time to time, but yes, Mr. Conroy is basically saying interested parties have until March the 30th to lodge their submissions, communications, yes, in relation to what it thinks the broadband policy should be. Now, bear in mind that you've got Easter in amongst this. That's probably only a week. So you just got to wonder, where are they coming from with these, some of these sort of things?
Was this announcement made on a Friday afternoon, by any chance?
March the 17th, apparently. Was that Friday?
That's today, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. No, it wasn't made on a Friday afternoon. Then.
It might not be today if you're listening to the podcast, of course.
That's right.
Oh,
of course, yes. It could be yesterday, the day before that.
It could be a week ago.
Yes. And in other news too, the ACCC to expose fake excuses for broadband delays. Now, this one caught my eye as it went through, which is...
Other than running out of space in telephone exchanges.
Well, that one they've found the first time.
That was a real one.
They've investigated that and have given that the green tick.
Okay, that's been given the thumbs up. It's a valid excuse.
Yeah, valid excuse.
What's a fake excuse?
Oh, I don't know. But I reckon they'll probably find a few. but I just thought that was interesting. But the competition regulator, the ACCC, is set to probe what's stopping Telstra's rivals rolling out broadband services and whether they are real blocks like space constraints, which is what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Speaking at an ATUG, which is the, what is it, the Telephone
Users Group? Australian Telecommunications Users Group.
They had their little shindig up in Sydney recently when he was Graham Samuel was having a bit of a chat.
It was last week. Yep.
Yes, and basically he's vowed to check it all out and make sure that the excuses are genuine,
legitimate.
Yeah. So that's good. I don't know what they'll actually turn up. I don't think there's any skullduggery going on out there, really. Do you think? Apart from a full exchange, there's no...
A dog ate my record card. I don't know.
Oh, don't talk
to me about connect to your telephone lines. I'm sorry. That wouldn't be a valid excuse,
wouldn't it?
No.
Oh, well. It's interesting to see what goes on. All right. Our feedback address, if you can... I've turned the spam filters off, and you've probably noticed the increase in spam.
No, I haven't.
No? Oh, no. Good. Yes. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au if you'd like to send us an email while we're chatting on air tonight. I did get an SMS the other day, which made me laugh. It said, go easy on Telstra, Sol. But we got the phone number from the from the person who sent the SMS to us.
Did you ring Sol back?
No, I didn't actually, but I've got your number now, Sol. So
if you want to send us an SMS, message 0430582077. Or if you're outside of Australia, it's +61 430582077.
I'm amazed you can remember all these
SMS
numbers.
SMS us from anywhere in the world.
An email just in from Cisco. Hang on, let me curse it back up and I can actually read it out. Cisco lives in the United States. It says, hi guys, missed your last show. The car died and I was trying to get it fixed.
Oh dear.
You don't know anyone with a few hundred extra dollars lying around, do you? I've got a few things for you. So I'll try and keep them short.
Okay.
Cisco listens to us in the car, apparently, when he's driving to work. First up, Fox News here in the United States, one of the news companies that is even remotely neutral and objective, had their tech team run a comparison over the major operating systems for home computers.
Yep.
And you wouldn't know it, the winner wasn't Windows. Yeah. It says go figure. Item 2 and 3 are down there, but I haven't read them yet, so I'll get back to you on that. So that's what Cisco has done. He sent us some good stuff through there.
Thanks, Cisco. Good luck with your car as well.
Yeah. Yes.
But which were the most useful operating systems?
Doesn't say. Cisco, if you're listening to us, pull over. Send us an email.
Yeah.
If he's listening to us in the United States. There was also another interesting news thing that came out during the course of the week, which got a few click-throughs on the newsletter this morning, I might add.
Right.
Have you got your newsletter?
I have, thank you.
Yeah,
comes
good.
Comes through every Monday morning.
How come you didn't click anti-software virus reviews?
Did I not click that?
No, you didn't. You must have missed that one in the past.
Maybe.
But, yes, there's been a new review come out in relation to antivirus software. And last year...
Oh, yes, I heard about this. Yeah, this is where Kaspersky came second.
That's right.
It?
Last year, Kaspersky seemed to do fairly well. I'm not sure whether it's the same result or not.
Right.
The same survey, should I say. But this year's winner, and if you've got our newsletter, you can click the link in the newsletter, and it'll take you through there. Bitdefender won the award for being the best antivirus software on the market at the moment.
Bitdefender.
Have you heard of it, Greg?
Yeah, I've heard of it. It's not one I've used, though.
No, neither have I. $29.95 is the US retail price for it, which
that's about in line with everyone. Yeah,
which isn't too bad.
Now, we just recently changed to Kaspersky.
Did you?
From the Computer Associates what used to be Vet Antivirus.
You've done very well.
Well, look, the Computer Associates one always worked and worked quite well. The issue that I had with it was that about 90 days out from my subscription expiring, every 15 minutes, without fail, I would get Internet Explorer open, so I don't use Internet Explorer as a web browser, and it would pop up this big warning saying, your subscription is about to expire, you must click on this link and re-register.
Is this the CA?
Yeah, and after this happened about 18 or 19 times in a row on the first day, I started to get a bit annoyed. Eventually, I just said, no, I'm not renewing this. This is very annoying.
Now, can I give you the opposite perspective of this?
Please do.
I work at a company where we've actually sold quite a few people the CA antivirus product. We always used to support Vec because it was a local product, became CAs, and we kept...
Can I just say CA is number 9 of 10 on the list?
Yep.
CA is number 9, is it?
Yeah, right. I'll read out the list in a sec.
Yep.
But I would quite often get machines, you know, customers would come in that I haven't seen for a while or, you know, whatever it might happen to be, customers' home machines that I only see once in a blue moon. And they would come in and their antivirus would be out of date and it would have its last update, you know, a year ago or 6 months ago. And they'd sit and you'd ask them, well, why haven't you renewed your antivirus? It's not updating because you haven't renewed it. And they say, oh, did I have to renew that? Oh, I didn't know. So this is the dilemma that the antivirus software people have got.
I don't understand how they could possibly have missed the reminders from CA.
Perhaps CA have wound the reminders up.
Kaspersky's not bad either in reminding you either.
Yeah.
Normally 14 days out, they start going, hey, buddy, check this, click this box here, you got to update.
Although, that wouldn't be the most annoying thing about Kaspersky antivirus.
No, it has its problems, but it's also very safe, and I'd rather have a few problems than... you know, a few small viewing problems than actually other...
Most annoying thing about the Kaspersky antivirus is, of course, that squealing pig.
Is stuckpig.web or whatever the hell it is.
Well, you can change that, but it's a shocker at 2
right
in the morning
with the jingles out of you at 3 a.m.
Even if you've got the laptop turned down, it can still wake the house.
Well, let me tell you, you've got your headphones on and your audio editing and you're not, not expecting that to happen.
And but it just happens if someone sends you a dodgy email, you know.
Yeah, that's right. It'll happen out of the blue, yeah.
Phishing things. It'll just scare the bejesus out of
anyone. It does.
Yeah.
Number one was Bit... Are we going...
Yeah, I'll just read this out before we go to the break. Number one, Bitdefender came in. It had 5 stars, which is rated as excellent. You can follow along with me, by the way, at http://anti-virus-software-review.top10reviews.com. If you didn't get that, get the newsletter and click the link.
Newsletter, yeah.
And if you want to get the newsletter, come to the Tech Talk Radio website. You can do that. Number one, Bitdefender. Number two, with silver medal, was Eugene's product, Kaspersky. That's $39.95. I'll read out the prices to give you a bit of a feel. It also got 5 stars, but for obviously there was one thing, it didn't have registry protection as well as what Bitdefender did. And registry is a fairly important part of the Windows operating system. People like getting in there and tinkering. Or should I say, malicious code likes getting in there and tinkering with it and can do some nasty things. Coming in number third is one which I've never heard of called Esset Nod 32. If anyone's ever heard of that, got the bronze medal.
Come across that one?
No. No. Number four, Trend Micro's Antivirus Plus Anti-Spyware.
Yep. You see that around a lot as a pre-installed thing on machines. Yeah.
That got 4.5 stars. Still coming in number four. Number five was F-Secure Antivirus.
Yep.
Number six coming in at, oh, that's fairly expensive at $60.89.
F-Secure.
Coming in at number six was McAfee's Virus Scan.
Oh, good old McAfee. That's the first of the real mainstream ones right down at number six.
Yep. Followed by another mainstream one, number seven, which was Norton Antivirus.
Yep.
Number eight was AVG Antivirus Pro.
Okay.
That got, they're all pretty good, don't get me wrong here. They're all 4.5 stars. Number eight, AVG. Number nine was CA Antivirus.
Yep.
And number 10, rounding out the top of the antivirus programs for 2008, was Norman Virus Control, if anyone's heard of that. I haven't heard
of
that.
Yeah, I've come across that one, yeah.
Have you? Yeah, so there you go. If you go to that website, which I gave out, anti-virus-software-review.top10reviews.com, it's a mouthful, really.
Mm.
You can see all the pros and cons down there. You can click through and follow it around if you're interested in that sort of stuff. Very well worthwhile.
Now, these desktop antivirus products, because there are server-based antivirus products, one of which I've got in mind that you haven't mentioned at all.
I'd say they would be desktop.
A lot of these companies, though, do have
enterprise-wide type and server-based antivirus products, but they're based on the same basic underlying scanning engine.
Yeah, so like Kaspersky has a server.
They're
thing,
all which, yeah. They're all just fancy control mechanisms on top of the same underlying engine.
And here's a tip too: buy things online. I do. With the Aussie dollar being the way it is at the moment, apologies to our American friends. It's a very good value for money buying stuff from the US as opposed from the AU site.
Yes,
I did that. Found that out the other day. I renewed my Kaspersky. I think cost me $41.30 US. Which was something like $56 or $60 here in Australia. So,
wow.
And even with a conversion rate of 93 cents, which they were quoting, it came out to be about $48.
Some pocket money.
$5 or $6 there in a conversion. So worthwhile shopping around internationally if you're going to do things online. Anyway, we're running out of time. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Adam Turner's going to have a view from the couch. And we're going down the backup line again. I think something terrible's happened over there in the, off the couch. I think we're still sitting in this environment. So we'll be back after this.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage?
What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus have again had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPad.
Eddie's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to.
She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking to the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on E-Pray, and you get a whole service. Just on the, how does it go? It goes...
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
Dr. Ron, tell me about your backup regime. Have you got a good backup regime around at the doctor's surgery?
It's an ad hoc regime, but it's one that suits me, that works
quite
well.
How ad hoc? Weekly, daily, monthly, annually?
Oh, I go down the fortnightly to monthly path.
Oh, yeah?
You do it
manually, do you?
I do. What I try to do is keep all of my data in one particular place. So in a Microsoft Windows environment, it'd be in the My Documents directory.
Yep.
And then every fortnight or every month or so, I just drag the entire My Documents directory into, using Nero or one of those CD or DVD burning packages, just drag it in and dump it onto a disk and burn it.
Very good.
That seems to work for me. You do have to be aware that if you're using particular types of applications like Microsoft Outlook for email, they will put particular files and data files in areas automatically other than My Documents, and you need to make sure that you back up your folder files and other data files.
Absolutely.
But for the most part, it works well for me. But everyone's got their own particular way of doing things.
Yeah, I used to use an automated software, which I think it was VSync, it was called. But one of our listeners of the program put me onto a really good backup program called S7, I think it was, which I'm just going off my memory here. That was a while back, and I swear by that now. That's really good. It does nice backups across drives and things like that. I actually use it between two servers to back up essential business files from one remote location to another remote location, which seems to do the job quite nicely. But I think nothing really compares to having a second drive with all your material on it. It's don't back it up to the same drive, for goodness sakes, because they fail. Graham, what's your... Have you got a good tip for backups and all that, briefly?
Yeah, probably haven't got much to add. I'm one of those people that's bad at doing backups, actually. Much as I advise everybody that I know to do backups, I'm one of those ones, yeah, I've got a... Yeah, several hundred gigabytes in my machine, and yeah.
Okay, well, we won't embarrass you any further then. But poor old Adam seems to be having a run for his money over when he sits on the couch and sends his reports across. This is the second one, nearly in as many days, about backups, which I'm not saying is bad, but obviously something has happened.
Something
he hasn't let us on
yeah.
for what it is.
I would have thought he'd be using Time Machine by now, because he's gone over to the other side. He's using Apple Macs.
He has.
A lot more. Is he in Time Machine? Or about to find out, maybe.
Right, let's take a listen, and we'll see what the current dilemma is. Here's Adam Turner's view from the couch.
Adam Turner's view from the couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Regular listeners will know I'm a little obsessive when it comes to data backups. Fire, theft, hard drive failure, data corruption, general stupidity. Such things don't just happen to other people. If you tend to take a notebook on the road, then you're particularly vulnerable to data loss. You can always back up to a USB device or a memory card, but the best form of backup is off-site. Since I turned to the Mac side of the force, I've been looking for the perfect backup system, and I seem to have found it in the most unlikely of places, Amazon. Amazon's Simple Storage Service, or S3, offers unlimited online storage for an insanely low 15 US cents per gig for data storage. Amazon also charges 10 US cents per gig for data uploaded and 18 cents per gig downloaded. There's no sign-up fees and no monthly fees, meaning you can safely back up all your computers for only a few dollars a month. Of course, this is assuming you've got a good internet plan that won't sting you too badly for excess usage. To make life easier, if you've already got an Amazon shopping account, which practically everyone does, you can use the same billing details and be up and running in minutes. Now, Amazon's S3 is only half the solution. You also need S3 compatible backup software. Enter JungleDisk. JungleDisk runs in the background, regularly uploading change files to your S3 account, and you can throttle the speed so it doesn't choke your internet connection. The best thing about JungleDisk is that it's available for Mac, Windows, and Linux, and that $20 buys you unlimited licenses so you can protect your Windows machines at home as well as the MacBook Air or ASUS EPC you like to take on the road. You can also mount your JungleDisk storage area and treat it like a local drive, which is great for sharing files between your computers. For an extra US $1 a month, you can even access your files through a web browser from any computer connected to the internet. If you're worried about security, you can encrypt your files. Amazon's S3 combined with JungleDisk would seem an excellent solution for both home and work users. You can store 10 gig worth of photos in an enterprise-grade data center for around $2 per month, with everything automated so you can set and forget it. Not so long ago, such a service would have cost you hundreds of dollars. Today, if you can't afford to lose it, you can certainly afford to store it on S3. S3 is a fine example of the world to come, where everything is available as a service. Unlimited storage, unlimited bandwidth, unlimited processing power for just a few cents will mean everything will live in the cloud and be at your fingertips wherever and whenever you need it. Combine this with a suite of integrated online services such as those from Google, Yahoo, or Microsoft, and you've got the building blocks of ubiquitous computing, where technology becomes seamlessly integrated into every aspect of our lives. The brave new world is coming, whether we're ready or not.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
A-Drive's one that I've tended to use in the course of time. What about you, Dr. Ronnie? You use that too, don't you?
I do, now myself. And
that's free, 50 gig for free?
It's huge.
Free for free?
Free for free, it's huge. It's
sorry, really international listeners, you wouldn't get that.
No.
Stupid ad campaign
it
here
is.
By someone here.
Don't go there.
No, because we're not advertising for them. A-Drive.com is the address, and yeah, it's a massive amount of storage. It's completely free. They've got a great little user interface, which you can access through your web browser from anywhere.
One of the best things about those guys, basically, A, it's free. Now, I know Adam was talking about one which was 15 cents a gigabyte or something like that, which isn't too bad when you think of things. You know, you could go buy a hard drive, you'd probably do worse than 15 cents a gig. But with A-Drive, let's face it, we all have digital cameras and we all have fantastic prize photographs that could never ever be replaced if the joint burnt down or the computer gets nicked or whatever it is like that.
Yep.
And for the investment of time only, and as Adam said, a good bandwidth sort of thing, I couldn't recommend anyone further than A-Disk to actually just have file space where they're going to let you store their stuff for free.
I wonder if Adam thinks that someone like Amazon might be a little bit more guaranteed to be there in the long haul with his data on it rather than maybe a free service that might not necessarily be there in 5 or 6 years' time.
Yeah, that may be a thought.
Hmm.
But having said that, if you check regularly, like I know A Drive's been there for a while.
And if it's only the backup, then you can always choose someone else. Yeah.
The other thing that I'd like to look at is, I think Adam is talking about, especially Jungle Disk there, you can load software. Now, he mentioned software you could install for Windows and Mac and also Linux, I think he said at the start of his account. So what he's talking about here is that the backup process is automated. You can configure it to happen without you having to worry about it. The issue with a system like A Drive is that you manually have to go to the website and upload files which you want to back up.
Hmm. But that's, I mean, some of us do the backups that way anyway. I mean, when I say before, I've got nothing backed up. There are a few critical things that are backed up. You know, those few irreplaceable things, like you were mentioning a minute ago, Andrew, they're the things that you do have copies of.
For the amount of angst it would cause you to lose the baby photos when they're, you know, 2 or 3 weeks old, do it. It's just not worth it. Spend a weekend. Not that we have many rainy weekends these days, except if you live in Queensland. Hello to all our Queensland listeners up there. Yes, it's something that everyone should do. Mm. So, backing up. Good regime.
Yeah.
Let's, before we move on, Cisco is prolific. He's sitting here sending emails by the... had about four in as many minutes in the last few bits. G'day, Cisco. Obviously, I read with interest your... the car's not fixed yet. Let me scroll down to this one down here. It says, the car's not fixed, and he loves telecommuting at 4:30 in the morning.
Is that what time it is at the moment?
I think he's in Chicago, around that part of the world, from recollection. I'll get another email in a second. You watch. But he did respond to our question, who won... I sent you a link to the article. Yeah, you did, but that's what happens when you're on air. The other systems name were Mac OS, Windows XP, Windows Vista, and Ubuntu, but the big cat came out on top.
Oh, well, the big cat.
Yeah,
the Apple cat.
That's the one.
The leopard.
Mm. So there you go. Now let's talk about Windows, because we're going to talk about Windows now. I had a chat with one of the Australasian Microsoft gurus during the course of last week. We had the Heroes thing here in Melbourne just last week, and you guys interested in Server 2008? Is anyone here remotely interested in Server
2008? No, I'm intensely interested, because this is what people like me are going to be working with into the next little while, and a lot of us have had great success with Server 2003 and its various offshoots. So I'll be very interested to hear what's coming up with the new version.
I was very lucky, I should say from the outset here, that as I did this interview, I was presented with a fully functional working version of Server 2008. So thank you very much, Microsoft. They did give us a copy. But then again, they gave everybody at the conference a working version of the new software. A couple of interesting things, I guess, apart from the obvious. It's a cut-down, lightweight version of what 2003 was. They've gone down this root of server core, which rather than loading up everything that you would think you would need, and I don't want to steal the thunder of Martin Gregory, who's coming up next, but why would you want to load Media Player onto a Windows server? Good question, huh?
Mm.
Well, Server Core does all this for you. It actually only lets you install the basic bits that you need, and then you plug in the other bits that you want to run on it, which I thought was really good. So as a result, instead of spending, and I'm exaggerating here, as my wife would say, 3 hours building a server. Oh, but then again, some people could spend that amount of time.
3 hours would be fairly fast. 3 hours to build a server, about right?
Yep. Server build. You can knock one up in pretty quick thing. And one of the things which I didn't go into, I don't think, in the interview, was the fact that Microsoft, at long last, have forced really complex administrator passwords. So you can't put in, you know, footy and your favourite football club or the dog's name or anything like that. So they're actually
administrator.
That's going to be a double-edged sword, though. One.
Well, it may well be, but it's going to stop these people getting in and spamming and, you know, doing things through servers which aren't securely locked down and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, one of the other interesting things that made the mainstream press this week, reports have emerged across web of the users all around the place that people are actually starting to use Server 2008 as a desktop instead of Windows Vista, because made from the same base code as Vista.
Yes.
some reports suggest that it was much faster than Vista, while others say it shouldn't make any difference. But anyway, for the diehards out there, I'm sure there's someone out there who's loaded up 2008 and running it as a workstation. There's no reason why he couldn't.
Roll on 2010, Windows 7's on its way.
But what? 2010, Windows 2007.
Windows 7 is on its way.
Conspiracy theorist.
No,
it's normally my role.
Is it? It's real, it's happening.
Yeah, 2010.
Who would use Windows Server 2008, Andrew? Is this all going to be explained?
This is all going to be explained.
Good.
So what we'll do, we're going to have a hear from Lyd first. We're going to take a break. And Lyd is talking about social networking sites. And today we're going to be talking about StumbleUpon, which he's going to tell us all about in just a second. We'll take a break, and then we're going to come back, and we'll be hearing from Martin Gregory, who is Director of Server Tools and Platform Strategy from Microsoft Australia. We found ourselves in a very noisy environment with air conditioning and all that sort of things in the
quiet ones.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. And we sat down and chatted there for a good part of 20 minutes thereabouts. And you'll hear that after that. But first up, let's hear about StumbleUpon, because you guys don't use it. I don't use it. I want to know what it's all about. Here's Lyd.
I've been having a chat with a few people recently about StumbleUpon, and most people seem to think that it's a bookmarking site. While it can be used to store and tag your favourite sites and pages, much like the original bookmarking site Delicious, it can be so much more than just being a place to dump all the junk from your favourites folder. StumbleUpon is a social network, a website that gives its users a new way to experience the web, one that's largely based on a recommendation system. I'm sure you've seen the stumble button at the bottom of blog posts, usually alongside the dig and Reddit buttons. When you stumble a post, you're adding it to the StumbleUpon database. By giving it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, you're telling the StumbleUpon community what you really think about that post or that website. When you thumb something up, it's automatically added to your StumbleUpon list of liked pages, and this is why a lot of people use it as a bookmarking tool. But adding content is only one way to use StumbleUpon. The other is to receive content. Instead of searching for specific topics using search engines, StumbleUpon users tag the subjects they're interested in, and then they surf that topic channel of the web. StumbleUpon makes it easy by providing a browser plugin that randomly takes you with a click of the stumble button to sites that fall under your selected tags. So why should you give StumbleUpon a go? Because StumbleUpon is known for its ability to send massive amounts of traffic from all over the world to websites. It's an incredibly powerful tool if you're trying to establish a following for your blog, website, brand or product. Once your content is in there, other stumblers will, well, stumble across it. And if it's good enough, if it's useful enough, they'll thumb it up and link to you. It's a gentle traffic pusher, consistent and continuous, sending hundreds or thousands of visitors a day. And continuous is important because while hitting the front page of Dig can send you tens, if not hundreds of thousands of visitors over a few days, it's a short-lived spike that doesn't continue to send you traffic. I've been stumbling for nearly a year, but originally I used it as a bookmarking site without knowing about its other cool features. More recently, though, I've begun adding friends, stumbling other people's sites, and other people have stumbled my posts. In the last month, two posts on Blogwell were stumbled, and now they bring in between 100 and 6,000 unique visitors a day. Over the past 30 days, we've had more than 97,000 visitors from StumbleUpon alone. So if you're interested in getting to know StumbleUpon, go to StumbleUpon.com, join and download the toolbar, which is available for both Internet Explorer and Firefox, install it and start setting up your StumbleUpon homepage. Before you add your site, go to reviews.StumbleUpon.com to see whether it's already there. You never know, someone may have stumbled some of your stuff. If not, start by going to your site's homepage and clicking the blue thumbs up symbol that has I like it next to it. It'll turn green and that means you've stumbled. Once you hit that button, it should open up a panel that allows you to write a short description about your site and tag it with specific keywords. And this is part of the trick. Make sure that you tag each page well so that StumbleUpon sends other stumblers that have similar tags to visit you. While it's not considered good practice to stumble your own material, if you've created a great post that just begs to be promoted, ask a friend to submit it for you. Or if you've been thumbing up other people's content and contributing to the StumbleUpon community for a while, it's okay to stumble your own posts sometimes. If you truly want to benefit from StumbleUpon, take Muhammad's advice from a few weeks ago. Get to know the community. Check out and join the groups that most interest you. Tag your favourite subjects and make sure you click the thumbs up button in your toolbar every time you come across an amazing site. It only takes a few seconds. If you want a more comprehensive guide to StumbleUpon, visit doshdosh.com and search for StumbleUpon. If you've enjoyed hearing about StumbleUpon or have any other social media questions, please email me, lyd@techtalkradio.com.au, and I'll do my best to hunt down the answers. This is Lydia Davis from Silicon Valley for Tech Talk Radio.
Microsoft has released the latest version of its Windows operating system for servers, thrusting itself into the market for virtualization technology that allows one computer to act like many machines. Windows Server 2008 marks Microsoft's first major challenge against VMware, the leader in virtualization, by building the technology into its core operating system. For the time being, Microsoft will ship Windows 2008 with a test version of its Hyper-V technology, which adds an extra layer of software that sits between the operating system and the hardware. But it expects to add the full feature to the software within 6 months. Recently at Microsoft's Heroes Happen launch here in Melbourne, I caught up with Martin Gregory, Director of Server, Tools and Platform Strategy from Microsoft Australia, about Windows Server 2008, where we discussed what's new in the company's latest server offerings.
Martin, Windows Server 2008 built from the same code base as Vista, therefore it shares a lot of its architecture and functionality. So what's new in Server 2008?
Okay, well, we've really concentrated on a few key areas with Windows Server 2008. The first one of those that we should talk about, I know is really important and the top of mind for IT professionals and developers, is security. So really thinking around how Windows Server 2008 becomes that secure and trusted platform. And a couple of the things that I think are significant there. The first one is NAP, or Network Access Protection. And network access protection plays very well to reducing the burden of time that an IT professional needs to spend and a better experience for the end user. So what NAP allows me to do is to set a policy, if you like, that says, hey, in order for a laptop to connect into my environment, it needs to have latest virus signatures, personal firewall turned on, and those sorts of things. And if you imagine somebody takes a laptop out of their environment and installs some dubious software, what happens the next time that person goes to connect is it will do a check of that machine, and if anything's not right, it will actually send them to a quarantine area so they actually get the fix. So if you think about that, it saves that help desk, that whole round of help desk call, so it's a better experience for the end user, and it reduces that time in terms of an IT support person having to do that. You know, security is important, so a couple of the other things that I'd include in that discussion would be read-only domain controller. So customers like Symbian Health Services in Australia run 600 remote locations in pharmacies in some very far away places in Australia, in rural locations. And essentially they're using the read-only domain controller for that extra level of security in those branch office remote environments. And the other one, which I think has applicability for a number of different roles, if you like, would be Server Core. And Server Core came about to say that, you know, if a server's sitting in a rack somewhere with no keyboard or mouse or monitor attached to it, why would we want to install Media Player and Explorer, and in fact a whole bunch of other pieces of technology as well? So Server Core gives a minimal install platform for people to build on. And the benefit of that is it really does dramatically reduce any kind of attack surface. So we know security is important. We've done a lot in the new Windows Server 2008 around security.
Server 2003 and the likes have been notoriously heavy installs. They take a while to install, whereas 2008 is being, you know, promoted as a fairly lightweight install. How long does it take to install 2008?
We've dramatically reduced the install time. So depending on which pieces you want to install on top of Server Core, you know, would depend on the install time. But essentially, we've dramatically reduced the amount of bits that either go over the wire or direct onto that machine. And, you know, if I think around the design, the development process for how we built Windows Server 2008, we looked long and hard at different specific workloads. So what does a web server need to have on it, and what should it look like? What should a branch office server look like, and the pieces of technology? So we've thought a lot about those different workloads for installs. But Server Core is that sort of foundation, if you like. Whether you're in a, you know, a physical environment or you want to create virtual machines, Server Core is a useful building block for folks.
So rather than installing a lot of services, which was traditional in 2003, you only install what you need really to have the server running, then add on other bits that you need, is that right?
Yeah, and we haven't taken anything away, so there's still full install options, but the feedback that we got was, you know, the time that it takes to patch and maintain those additional components like Internet Explorer, if you're not going to use those, why have them on the server? And that's really where Server Core came from.
So who's the target market for Server 2008? Who should buy it?
Certainly, from a Microsoft perspective, this is absolutely the most secure server operating system that we've built. And I see a couple of things for that. If I use that Symbian example that we were just talking about, they had 600 Novell servers in different branches. And the reason that they wanted to actually move over was they reduced their install time from 8 hours down to 2. So if you multiply that across the number of sites and the number of servers, that's a significant time saving. And one of the challenges for IT departments is to reduce the amount of time spent in maintenance mode, in securing systems and patching systems and looking after things, and spend more time innovating and adding value and creating things for the business. So we're excited about that.
Backward compatibility of 2008, how well does a Windows 2000 client, or maybe even, heaven forbid, a Windows 98 client work? Obviously, there's a lot of the toing and froing that you spoke about before when it comes to like virus protection and things like that. It works beautifully with Vista, I would imagine, but how does it go with some of the other earlier operating systems?
Yeah, there's certainly a better together story with Vista in terms of some of the changes that we've made with security and communications and those things together, but you know, you're asking a great question there, and there are definitely benefits for XP clients in terms of migrating a server from 2003 to 2008. And with some of the changes that we've made in the communications protocol, people would certainly notice that increase in speed. But we've also extended out through working with partners to make sure that things like NAP are available for Linux clients. So, you know, we heard again that interoperability is important for customers who have systems of different needs. So we focused pretty hard on that with Windows Server 2008 too.
Tell us a little bit more about the network access protection and who's really going to benefit from it, apart from the IT guys, where they're going to have to be doing less maintenance. Are there any other benefits from it?
Yeah, it's certainly a better experience for the end user. So it avoids that help desk call, but I guess if I thought about a really challenging IT environment, La Trobe University, you know, have a huge network that supports students, teachers and researchers. And, you know, you can imagine in that environment they get an enormous influx of some 10,000 students on day one all trying to log on. So essentially they put NAP into their environment to really give them a granular set of controls. And, you know, if I think about that from the people point of view in terms of time, it's actually putting that burden on the technology rather than on the IT department.
One of the biggest fears of IT people is these memory sticks, these flash drives. A fantastic way to promote unscrupulous software throughout an organisation. In fact, a lot of people don't even know they've got nasty things on their flash drives. Admittedly, that's probably at a client level, but does the network access protection actually, you know, when a laptop comes in, it obviously looks for nasty things. Can it look beyond just that drive and see what else, like if there's some hardware, a removable drive in it, for example?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there is much more in the client area. And as you know, we innovated again with Vista in terms of, you know, if I think back on the client side, you know, I shudder to think when I was helping my parents install Windows 98 on a laptop and it says, how many disk blocks would you like the page file size to be? You know, it's probably not the right kind of question to ask an end user. You know, with XP, the system manages that thing for you in small time slices. With Vista, it'll realize if there's a USB stick sticking out of it, it can use that for cache. So, you know, I think we've done a lot on the client side in terms of that innovation, but, you know, security is around not only technology, it's around policies and practices as well. So, you know, we work with a whole range of different customers and you know, some disable functionality, and some use thinner kind of clients. So there's a whole range of different options there. But as we said right at the beginning of our discussion today, you know, security is important. And if I think about a couple of the areas, other areas on Windows Server 2008 where I'm particularly pleased in what we've done, virtualization would be one. You know, it's a hot topic in the industry,
absolutely.
And there's been a lot of buzz around that. And with Windows Server 2008, in the box there's the hypervisor code, which is really that very small and efficient layer right down low in the operating system, which provides that kind of virtualization. But there's a quote from Tom Bittman, who's a VP at Gartner and an analyst, that he says, you know, virtualization on its own, without proper management, is more dangerous than not having virtualization at all. And we absolutely see the center of gravity being how you manage that environment. So through one pane of glass, you get to see your physical environment and your virtual environment together. And we think that that's important. So there's a pre-release version of the hypervisor code in Windows Server 2008, and we'll release the final Windows Hyper-V code within 180 days from the end of February. And there's been a lot of excitement here today. You know, we're talking at the Melbourne Heroes Happen Here launch with over 1,000 customers, and there's been a lot of energy around that virtualization piece, so I'm pretty happy about that.
You mentioned security. We've been predominantly talking about it on this side or on the client side of the firewall. Are there any major improvements to keep the nasties out from the internet point of view?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we've seen a really strong adoption from the hoster community in Australia, and that's because a lot of the things, when I mentioned around designing for role specifics and thinking about where those servers end up, there's a lot of benefits in there for hoster. But behind the firewall as well, I'll give you an example. One of the things in the web area, if you like, now is feature delegation. So rather than give someone administrative rights for the entire box, what I can do is to pass over the web engine, if you like, and give them administrative kind of rights on that so they can test their application or what have you, but I keep the integrity of the box. And we know that that's important behind the firewall, but also in that hosted environment. It gives that extra level of flexibility to be able to delegate those things out and let somebody really do dev and test.
Right, let's talk about some of the new features of Server 2008. IIS, or the Internet Information Service, has been rock solid with IIS 6 as something that's been near and dear to my heart over the course of the last few years. IIS 7, what's new? How have you improved something that's always been sort of traditionally pretty good?
Well, IIS 7 is our single biggest step forward in web server technology. And, you know, we've seen some great performance numbers. So on IIS.net, our folks can go there and have a look at some of the performance improvements and what that means. If I think around the web piece, one of the areas that we talked about interoperability earlier, one of the areas where we've had a close partnership with Zen Corporation is around PHP. So if customers want to run PHP applications on Windows and then take advantage of some of the business class services from the Windows platform, they can do that. And we've made that a native multi-threaded process inside IIS 7. So the performance is fantastic. And we've seen benchmarks from 300 transactions per second up to 6,000. So I'm really pleased around web. And if I think around the launch of these three products together, the new SQL Server 2008, the new Windows Server 2008, and Visual Studio, coupled together with technologies like Silverlight, we really are going to turn on the next generation of those web applications, if you like, become much more engaging.
Well, that leads on to, I guess, terminal services, really. Remote app, what does this do?
So I think this is a great thing for Australia. So we talked a little bit about branch offices earlier and having a lot of remote sites. And, we're talking a lot about the server products, but it's really important that we consider the end user experience of using those products. So, if I open my laptop with two icons on it, I can click on one and it's locally installed and would execute like a regular application. I can click on the icon next to that and it could execute out of a data center in Perth. But from the user point of view, it gives me the same experience. And we know that that's important. So no flicking of screens or windows in Windows or additional logons. And we think that that remote application is a powerful capability.
It's got to be a good thing for a network administrator too, in a lot of respects, because rather than looking after a lot of programs on a lot of clients, that's now been brought centralized back to the one server, so that it's executing on one server, so it's only one install in a lot of respects, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, that's about choice. People could go 100% on-premise or 100% off-premise, but it's about that choice to do that. So perhaps you'd look by application type. If it's an application like Office, you probably want it to be locally installed so folks can take it with them and work when they're offline. But if you thought about an application which had frequent changes or a lot of things happening to it, it might make more sense in that environment to run that out of a central location, so changes to that application are much, much easier for the IT department to manage.
Are there any types of applications that can't be run through this process, or are they, like an Office program obviously can be, but other, like processor intense applications, can they be run through this method?
Application compatibility is a key issue, and if I think around some of the largest customers in Australia, they have multiple thousands of internal applications. So, when we talked around virtualization, it's important to have that holistic view around virtualization, not just in the server space, but we just talked about terminal services remote app. That's all that is presentation virtualization. It's remoting that presentation. And if I think about application compatibility with a soft grid technology, Office is a bad example because I can run different versions side by side. But if I picked an internal application built on VB with different versions, or I picked a Microsoft product like Access, I can't run multiple versions side by side. So the soft grid technology allows me to virtualize that application and virtualize the registry. So essentially I can have non-compatible versions of the application installed in the same system. And we've seen an incredible ramp up on the soft grid technology with some of our large larger customers, because that's where they get a lot of that challenge in terms of testing and deploying applications.
What's the future of VPNs then, virtual private networks, if we're now moving down this line of thing? Obviously, people are still going to want to talk and upload data, and they're now going to do that through an application, like even an accounting program or something. They can just sit at home and basically update their data files at the server at work through virtualization. Are VPNs sort of dead and buried now?
Well, if I think about the data center of the future, you know, the thing is virtual. So whether it be networking or whether it be storage or whether it be a server or a presentation, you know, it's going to become a virtual environment. And what that enables us to do is to look at an environment in the data center that's more self-healing, and it is driven by models and policies. So right from the time when a developer writes that application, you know, they can hit a button and describe how that application works and installs. So when you pass that information over to the management tools, it has a really good view of how to install and work with that thing. So certainly, you know, using virtualization technology for connecting in, we'll avoid that VPN step, but we see it as broader than that in the data center, and we think that will encompass, you know, networking, storage, and in fact the entire data center.
Let's talk about the server core now. I think this is probably one of the most it has the most initiative, I think, in the whole Server 2008 product, with the ability to load up only what you want. Talk to me about the installation options. You get your base entry level where you put your server software in and it installs up. Then what? Do you get the user interface like you used to have in 2003, where it says, you know, configure my server, or how do we go about putting on other apps?
Well, the answer is yes to both. You do. So all of the things that you're used to doing in 2003, if you want to install all of the bits, it's a very similar experience. Server Core is really designed to reduce that manual effort of patching systems and working with systems by giving you that smaller footprint and that smaller attack surface. What we've seen from a lot of the customers who've been who have Windows Server 2008 deployed, or have been part of the early adopter program, or have been doing their own work around the beta, is quite often they'll snap an image of the server that they want. So they'll use Server Core as a building block, add on the additional components that they want, and then using technology like PowerShell, you know, can actually go and script out what they want to happen in that environment. And, you know, we've been focused on the user interface across the last couple of releases to reduce from 10 mouse clicks down to 5, down to 3. And a good example of that would be clustering. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I think with Windows 2000, if you wanted to set up clustering, you know, there was a lot of reading to do, and it wasn't a simple process. Right now, in Server 2008, that's a three-click wizard. And, you know, I can set up geographical clustering. So customers like Bridgestone have got very simple to implement geographical clustering on their Exchange system, which is giving them that extra level of reliability.
You mentioned PowerShell just briefly there. It's a new scripting and environment language. How does that work? Do you need to have an understanding of scripting code and all that to get it to work properly? Or?
Yeah, look, what we've seen there is if someone's able to, or working with Perl scripts or anything like that today, they can very quickly get to grips with PowerShell. It's interesting, we showed PowerShell, I think something like 9 months ago at one of the big Linux shows, and there was a round of applause which died away quite quickly, I think, when people realized that it was a Microsoft technology. But what it allows you to do is to really think around how you want to automate the deployment and the tasks that you've got at hand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are parts of the UI where you can essentially do something in the user interface and it will generate part of that PowerShell script for you. So, you know, I don't see that as a huge barrier for IT professionals to get across. A lot of those guys do some simple scripting today.
In essence, it's really going to allow automation of what used to be done manually. Is that its primary role?
Absolutely, yeah. So if you want to do something once or twice, you know, the user interface is great for that. But if you want to do it tens of times or hundreds of times or even thousands of times, you know, scripting is something that, you know, if I think about Unix administrators, they've been using sort of their professional sort of shells and scripts and all that sort of stuff for some time. And really it enables you to drive Windows in a much more automated way.
Let's look briefly at migration from 2003 to 2008. Any recommendations, hints, tips, or just new box, start again? What would you recommend?
what I always encourage people to do is to try the technology in their own environment. So, you know, when you install with your own people, on your own hardware, with your own internal applications, that's really when the technology becomes real and customers see the value. But it's interesting, there have been a set of features, if you like, or a set of benefits that have been almost like a single driver for upgrades. So we talked about server core and reducing patching. We talked about read-only domain controller and giving that extra level of security. You know, we talked a little bit about remote app. And a lot of these things are just really addressing some of the problems and challenges that folks had. So we're seeing a good deployment across a different cross-section of loads, and from a range of customers, from, you know, very large companies in Australia right down to small as well.
Just to conclude our discussion, Mun, we've had a look at what Server 2008 does, and to summarise, it's probably taking a lot of client apps and putting them on the server with virtualisation. Do you think at some stage down the track we're going to go even further than that? Like, it potentially we won't even need to install a server, but software, we'll be able to get it direct from Microsoft so that we can actually remove the server from our office, so we take it back yet another step. Is that potentially what we might be seeing in a few years' time?
Yeah, absolutely it is, and it comes down to choice again. Some people will always want to have 100% of their environment in their location and under their control, and other people will be at the other end of the spectrum. And I think, you know, it may be a case where some workloads go to more of that hosted model a little bit quicker, and perhaps some don't. But I always think it's an important thing to be able to make that decision with a good background of information, and that's not just a technology decision, it's a policy and process, and one that's quite frankly right for the kind of business or the kind of environment that somebody's in. So that mix of, you know, software plus services, if you like, you know, potentially I see where we do a lot of updates over the wire. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the sort of self-healing data center. You know, rather than pages going off, it would be great if the technology was saying, hey, by the way, I went and grabbed that thing for you and I fixed up the server and there was no problem. I did that because it indicated we were at 80%, you know, capacity, so I went and took this move. And as long as the IT department is in control by being able to set their policies and models to the way that we want them, we think that that's a great innovation in the future.
Mun, thank you for spending the time and talking to us on Tech Talk Radio today. It's been terrific.
That was great. Thanks very much.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And thank you to Microsoft for that lovely chat there about Server 2008. I hope everybody learned some things. We'll be asking questions later, like... how many times did Graham say garchiver.com in the news? If you have the correct answer to that, you can win yourself a coffee cup.
Yes. Go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Tell us and you'll win yourself a coffee cup.
Absolutely. Yes. Alrighty, let's keeping on.
Are you going to build one? Have you built one? A coffee cup?
Yeah, no, I'd like a Tech Talk Radio coffee cup. Can I have one?
I'll get one to you.
Yeah, good.
Yes, what about the Server 2008 device?
Yes, no, Microsoft did give me a copy on the day, so I think it's only I should do the right thing by it. I'll build it up, and I'll get back to you in a year or two's time.
You're a user of 2003?
Yes, I run... excuse me, I run two 2003 servers. One's a small business server, and one's just the standard enterprise server.
Yep.
And believe it or not, I'm still running a Windows 2000 box. Going to be retired and replaced with the 2008 box very shortly, I think.
Good stuff.
So, but no, all good stuff. Let's talk about Apple now, because we can, and I think it's only fair that we talk about Apple now. There's been a lot of rumours around in recent times about the pending arrival of these Apple Mega Mart superstores type sort of things.
Oh, the real Apple shops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the amazing cities that we have. Now, there's been all talk, and I guess we'll just add some, you know, fuel to the fire here. Reports that a third store will be opened in Australia this year comes as Aussies keenly await the opening of the first official Apple store in Sydney, with construction's nearly repeated. Sorry, I wish I could read tonight. Here in Melbourne, we've got one scheduled to be open in that suburb called Chadstone, which is really just a glorified shopping centre. And, yes, there's a third one hopefully coming soon at a town near you, which could also, actually, they don't actually say where it's going to be, but the third one is penciled for one of the major cities here in the not-too-distant future. So for those of you who want to go and buy your Apple and experience the Steve Jobs way of buying where there's no cash registers, I don't know how that works, but there's no cash registers, but they've also got tutorial rooms upstairs, so you can come in at any stage, I don't know, you have to book, and you can sit down and watch these gurus tell you or go through the Leopard Wares and check out the Big Cat for yourself without wasting too much time, I guess.
And is the one for Melbourne going to be part of the Chadstone Shopping Centre?
Yeah. I'm surprised Steve hasn't applied for his own postcode.
Yeah. Chadstone's massive enough as it is.
It is. It's just a shopping centre as one postcode, but yes. But no, the Apple Store, it's probably a good place for it, really, when you think about it, where it's a retailing mecca, and it could have three floors of just palatial white gleaming devices and people wearing black T-shirts and white runners.
Help desks for people trying to run iTunes. It's good.
So there you go. There's Apple coming to potentially. There's rumours plenty, and we never know what might happen here. But
how do you pay for this stuff?
I don't know. With blood.
With blood.
We have you now.
You can trade in your Microsoft Zune and you'll get an iPod.
You'll have to ask Adam. He's turned to the dark side, so he might be able to shed a bit of light on that, how he paid for his thing. I'll probably put a credit card in over the phone. He's probably paying it off still, too. Anyway.
Interesting.
Yes, now, while we're speaking of Apple, a lot of people have tried to compete with the Apple iPod, and some have done well and some have done not so well. Sansa Fuse, or, as you might sort of mistakenly call it, the Sansa Snooze, is just one device. The SanDisk is lighting the fuse that hopes will see the sale of its new MP3 video player, the Sansa Fuse, go off like a rocket, apparently, according to this media report that I think was in ITY. More and more are we seeing Apple clones come out for the iPod. Bit cheaper, bit better. But yet Apple seems to maintain their market share. This little device is, for example, the Sansa Fuse has got all the features that you would expect to find in an Apple iPod. The screen is slightly smaller, not by much, by 0.1 of a mil or something like that, so, you know, it's up there with a big screen. It's marginally thicker, but the reason why it's marginally thicker is that you can put an external hard drive a little memory flash stick into
the back of the thing. Well, of course, from SanDisk, you'd have to be able to put your memory card in it, wouldn't you?
Yes.
SanDisk being the big memory card.
That's what they're renowned for.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So, curious.
What do you reckon? You might buy one of those?
No, I've bought my iPod and I'm happy with it, actually.
You are an iPod user now, aren't
I
you?
I am, I'm afraid, yeah.
Have you filled it up?
Oh, no. Right. Oh, no, not even close.
What size is the capacity?
Oh, it's only 160 gig.
Only 160 gig. Right.
Is that all? 160?
Mm.
Okay. But I think that's a lot of MP3 music files you can get there, but you probably put them on as uncompressed, if I know you.
Some stuff there. I've got a lot of video on there as well, but it's still not even close to full, so...
Hey, can I start the war again? Can I mention iTunes?
Well, you need iTunes to talk to your iPod, but...
I'm just recalling last week's show where I mentioned iTunes.
Yes, I'm hesitating.
Come through and someone...
fiery.
Yes, something else, a bit of table thumping. Why should I put iTunes upgrades on when I can't even get movies in Australia? I remember that. That was quite funny.
I had iTunes running today. Which
did
was,
you? I did too.
Yeah.
That's quite an achievement.
Sorry.
Oh, dear.
I knew it would come out. And guess what? It prompted me to upgrade.
Yeah, so did mine.
And I ticked the box again and clicked, no, don't remind me about this again. I'm sure it'll ask me again next time I start it up. Is that just for the session? Is that for as long as iTunes is running, it doesn't keep prompting you to upgrade?
I don't know.
There is a service that runs in your Windows. It's called something like Apple Helper or something like that.
iTunesHelper.exe.
And there's also...
And run.
I always do.
There's also an Apple software upgrader that's separate to iTunes.
It tries to put what do you call it? QuickTime. Every time a QuickTime...
Yeah, it also looks after QuickTime and Safari and whatever other Apple software you might happen to have on your machine as well. iTunes might be reminding you, but something else might be reminding you as well if you don't do it.
Like a virus.
Well,
Xe's popping up all over the place. kill them.
Not quite. It doesn't self-replicate.
No.
Not like Facebook application.
Sony tried to do that with their anti-protection stuff. That's another story,
that's
really,
right,
isn't it?
Remember
that?
They stepped over that line.
They jumped over it.
They did.
They did the triple jump.
With gay abandon.
Absolutely. Yes. There's some emails in Cisco. Apparently he's in Stillwater, Oklahoma. I'll have to check that up on Gmap. You could have put the... we could have clicked it. It would have been good. He could have waved. But no.
Where the wind comes sweeping around the plains. Is that the... Oklahoma.
That's the lyric.
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's the stage play you're referring to.
Yes.
Okay. Musical, and he gets your gun or something like that.
It's actually called Oklahoma's, oddly enough.
There you go. I'm ignorant when it comes to these things. Jeff Dudley has sent us an email saying that... what did you say, Jeff? Wow, this sounds like a heck of a good product. He was referring to Windows 2008.
Server 2008, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, it really does, doesn't it?
I think it will be good. I will load it up and have a bit of a bash and see how it goes. I've got to get a new machine for it, but... Yes, I look forward to having a go.
Me too.
So, and there's a small business server version coming out, and there's the virtualization.
Do we know when the small business server is coming out?
They're talking about everything being another 180 days away, which is really unusual for Microsoft. But the VMware, which is traditionally an organization that provides virtual software for machines.
Yeah, they do virtualization, yeah.
Yeah, this will probably be their biggest threat, is what Server 2008 can do. But even still, the VMware equivalent in Server 2008 doesn't come out for a little bit just yet.
Okay.
It's got a bit to go. So don't buy it just yet. Wait, but there's more, which will come out in probably when SBS 2008 comes out. So
yeah, be worth watching.
Yeah. All right, let's take a little bit of a break, and we'll come back with more after I clear my throat in a moment.
You're listening to Digital Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Here's a story for our international listeners. If you live and listen to us in Cuba, there's some really good news. And the good news is that the communist Cuba has authorized the unrestricted sale of computers and DVD and video players, in the first sign that its new president, Raul Castro, the brother of the Fidel. Rather sick Fidel, I think, isn't he? He's not well.
He's not well again.
Yeah, he's moving to improve Cubans' access to consumer goods. The internal government memo seen by Reuters last Thursday said the appliances long desired by Cubans can go on sale immediately, although air conditioners will not be available until next year. Sorry about that.
Oh, and toasters.
And toasters just don't get a mention until 2010. It's a bit like digital TV, isn't it, in this country?
Mm.
You can't have your digital TV till 2010, nor can you have your toaster in Cuba.
What about cigars? Cigars you can have. I don't use electricity. The whole problem in Cuba is electricity.
Is that what it is? Is it?
Yeah. When the Soviet Union sort of wound up business, they stopped supplying heaps of fuel to Cuba, and they couldn't run their power generators. So there's a huge shortage of electricity.
Actually.
And
reading down the bottom of this article, Cuba's electricity supplies permit additional appliances to be sold freely in 2010, include toasters and electric ovens. The memo said. Oh, the memo.
There you go. And they've a little while ago, they set up some new generators that run on fuel that they're buying from Venezuela, and now they can have their fancy gizmos and gadgets.
Well, ovens
and join the Tech Talk Radio family.
Yay.
Absolutely. So welcome to all the Cuban listeners who'll be listening to the podcast shortly on their new computers. Probably,
but you never know. Like in a big city, we have people listening to us all over the world.
Ovens and toasters would be, they're extremely inefficient and extremely power-hungry devices.
Like plasma TVs. I wonder if they're going to bring those in over there, Gareth. Probably. Poor Adam wouldn't go well in Cuba, would he?
Well, toasters consist of a piece of coiled wire, basically, straight across the PowerPoint, don't they?
That's pretty much it.
They just get really, really hot.
There's got to be a better way to make toast.
It does.
Particularly if there's a power shortage.
We should look at that.
I think it's called fire.
Goodness me. All right, in other unsalubrious sort of news, sex.
Unsalubrious?
Yes.
Oh. You recently mentioned on this here radio show, Dr. Ron, that the domain sex.com went for squillions and squillions of dollars.
Yes.
There's a promo floating around on air, I think, at the moment that proves that.
Yes.
Now, would you believe that in the Asian domain name scramble, that is the .asian domain names that are now becoming available.
Did you register sex.asia?
No.
Someone must have.
It goes to auction. If there's a lot of people who want a name, it goes to auction. The highest bidder wins.
Yep.
So I reckon your $2 million's going to be well and truly usurped when it comes to this next run of domain names. In an article by Stuart Connor, who's ITY, he said, "Whoever said that porn did not dominate the internet, the land rush period for .asia domain names has just closed. Almost 300 domain names beginning with sex received more than one request for registrations and will be auctioned to the highest bidder. And 14 organizations claimed prior rights to use sex.asia.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Yeah, I am listening.
Residual, residual, how? And I
got some residual power.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
over a second, your fingerprints. Now,
we may have digressed.
Talk radio. Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600
donors and things are as good as you're not expecting, even if they do it for you.
Well, listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Son of my own!
For people who want to clean their floors in the dark, how about a vacuum cleaner with headlights?
Huh?
Huh? I can't shed too much light on this, no pun intended, but on the 12th of February this year, Electrolux, you know the mob that makes the vacuum cleaners?
Absolutely.
Was assigned a US patent, number 7,328,479, for a light on a cleaning attachment which can illuminate dust, dirt or debris in dark corners or under furniture. The patent...
We're all speechless over this side of the panel, aren't we, Graham?
The patent description says that the lighting device will comprise an LED oriented at an angle with respect to another one of the lighting devices. So,
if you whatever that means.
Yeah. Whatever that means. So, it's one of these very vague patent descriptions. But there you go. Look out for the new Electrolux LED headlight-powered vacuum cleaner. I'm assuming battery's not included, but... There we
go. Watch this space,
huh? But vacuums have had lights on them for years, haven't they?
I would have thought.
Yeah. Mm. You're obviously, they think they're onto a new thing.
All right. Let's move on, shall we?
We shall.
Yeah.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
This week's website, www.forlater.net. F-O-R-L-E-T-E-R. This
what?
Is a...
For what?
For later.
Oh, okay, yeah.
As in, this is for later.
Yeah, good.
A fantastic web-based email reminder system that I found. All you do is enter
I need one of these.
Yeah, you enter your email subject, the message, your email address, click on the time and date that you want it sent, and then click the button, remind me, and then at the date and time you specify, you get an email in your inbox. Now, here's one we prepared earlier. Just before I came here to do this show, I sent one to the feedback address.
Oh, okay. You want me to check it, Dave?
Andrew's going to check the feedback address.
Well, live radio at its best here.
This will probably fail completely, but that's all right if it does. But it works very well.
Just talk amongst yourselves.
Okay. That's a great little interface.
Good no, I'm sorry. The last email is from Jeff Dudley at this stage.
Oh, okay.
So this assumes that you're going to have your email on 24/7 to get the reminder.
Well, no. It just sends a message when you ask it to be sent.
Hmm.
Doesn't assume anything. I suppose if you don't have you're going to get it when you next start your email if it's not running.
Fair enough.
Hmm. But it might be useful for some applications.
I'm sure.
Yes. www.forlater.net, the Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Oddspot on Tech Talk Radio.
Popular online social networking site. And
we're making you work hard because you haven't been here for a few weeks. You know that.
It's my own fault.
It is.
An image sharing service, PhotoBucket.
Have you used
PhotoBucket?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. Last week banned images of babies in nappies.
What?
Saying that they violated its no nudity policy.
But this is going to nappy
out. PhotoBucket said the policy applied to people of any age and that images of babies in nappies threatened the safety and security of the site's users.
Yes, providing they were of not baby age, I can understand that.
Don't go there. The furor erupted after a US company called Good Mama Diapers ran a baby photo competition using PhotoBucket and had all of its entries deleted. However, on Friday last week, the content moderation manager at PhotoBucket decided to republish the removed pictures, apologising for having over-censored the baby photos.
Because that would have removed a lot of photos from most people's photo bucket, I would have thought.
Well,
then they share them.
Well, given that you you share the photos of your young children.
Lots of baby photos on photo bucket, yeah.
Would have thought so.
Americans have some very interesting views on censorship, don't they?
They do.
Yes. Anyway, we don't. And
we have very reasonable views, I would have thought.
I wouldn't have thought too. There's a vicious rumour going around at the moment too. I was just reading whilst
did an email arrive?
No, it hasn't.
No,
sorry,
sorry.
But I was reading something else at the same time. Has Telstra accidentally confirmed it's getting the iPhone?
Yeah.
There's a job application by Census looking for someone who cutting edge search application for the iPhone. Whoops, there you go. is that a giveaway for Census?
Mm. Was it in the news?
It was in the news.
Yeah, it was. Well, yeah, I heard about it somewhere. Read about it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, that's very funny. I thought.
Will Telstra be getting the iPhone?
Look, you never know. You're lucky in a big city, but when you think about it, they got the bucks, they got the network, and stands to reason.
Telstra, if it is Telstra, they will want a 3G version. They will not want to go to the old GSM technology with a device like that.
That's right. Yeah.
Got to be good.
All right, we'll talk about this more next week on Tech Talk Radio. Thank you for your company, wherever you might happen to be listening to us, around Australia, around the world, as we've proven tonight. It's been wonderful. Till next week, it's bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Hanlis, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.